This is fun! The FU Network.
Hey, Canada, welcome to Matter of Fact. I'm Ishat Reza.
And I'm Professor S. Why don't we get started?
Today, we're going to be talking about the layoffs that have been announced by a lot of different companies and some that may still come. People are facing a lot of uncertainty given the COVID-19 crisis. And we thought it would be helpful to go through what some of the options people have are when they face a potential layoff notice. So what we want to do is just sort of talk about kind of the general principles around layoffs. So obviously we're not giving legal advice here. There have been a lot of employment lawyers who've been talking on media and television and on Twitter and things like that. And, you know, people have been offering their advice. But what we're going to do here is just sort of talk generally about some of the principles. And then obviously in your specific circumstances, if you need legal advice, you need to consult a lawyer specifically. But we can talk about the general principles, and also Professor S will take us through some of the government's responses from a benefits perspective, or yep, providing support to Canadians in this difficult time. And then we thought we'd do something a little bit different this time. Instead of doing political and media fails, because there's so much negativity right now, that we'll do wins instead. So that'll be towards the end of the program. So for now, let's just start with what happens if an employer gives you a layoff notice. What do you think, Professor S? Good starting point?
That'd be a good place to start. I mean, we're seeing a lot of people on Twitter and other forms of media saying, just got laid off, I don't know what to do. And so there's, you know, a great deal of confusion and concern at this time. So maybe it's a good place to start, so people can just start to get a general outline of what's out there and what they should be thinking about, right, as they go through this very, very difficult process.
So, exactly.
a typical question is, you know, what if my employer is asking me to reduced hours? Like, do I have to? Like, are people required to do that? I mean, is that something that?
Right. Okay. So there'll be, so that's one way that some employers are trying to reduce their payroll costs at this point, is to say, okay, you have, like, you can work some reduced hours. Mm-hmm. The main thing is, you know, let's back it up a little bit. So if you get laid off, and you get this notice saying that, okay, as of this date, you're now laid off, or it's a temporary layoff, we'll call you back when things are better, and so on. The thing to remember is that an employer does not have a right to lay off an employee without giving them some kind of compensation. Now, there are some exceptions to that, and those exceptions are contained in your employment contract. So if your employment contract says that an employer has that right, then obviously they have that right. And then you look at, well, what are the parameters around that?
Okay.
That especially applies for people in a union context, because most unions, their collective agreements will have some kind of layoff provisions, and they usually do it, you know, by seniority and so on. And you have to follow whatever it says in the collective agreement for unions.
Okay.
But for everyone else who doesn't have an employment contract that says the employer has a right to terminate you, the employer actually does have legal obligations to make sure that they compensate you for the loss of your income. And the way that's calculated depends on your tenure with the employer, so how long you've been with them, the position that you had. The more senior you are, the more managerial your position, usually you get more money. Depending on your salary, so obviously the higher your salary, the more of a payout you get. Also depends on your age. So the younger you are, the way the law sees it is that, well, then it'll be easier for you to find your next gig. So, you know, you're not usually entitled to as much as, say, someone who's older, someone in their 50s, their 60s, and so on. So, you know, that's why these kind of situations, like if you find yourself in a position where your employer is saying, okay, we're laying you off and they're not offering you any compensation, you might want to actually get some legal advice to see that, you know, is this fair? If not, then what could be potentially what a court would award you if you did claim this was a wrongful dismissal. And so what happens in the case of a layoff that's not a permissible layoff, so for example, you know, it's not seasonal employment, it's not like in your employment agreement, et cetera, and so on, is that, you know, you are entitled to get your vacation pay, you're entitled to get some kind of payout. It's considered a constructive dismissal. Now, I know that people understand constructive dismissal as being like, oh, you know, if an employer makes things so unbearable for you that you resign, therefore it's constructive dismissal. That's true. That is one example of that. But another form of constructive dismissal is a layoff situation, except with those exceptions that I mentioned earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Now, here's a slight wrinkle. There are some employers, for example, restaurants right now, who've been told you cannot operate unless you do like a takeout situation or whatever, right?
So now we have the issue of what about the wait staff, right? I mean, we have a whole
range
of employees.
And that's the thing. Exactly. So if the employer can't reallocate that person, so like the waiter can't now go and help in the kitchen or something, then, you know, then I guess the employer may be able to legitimately lay the person off in the case of what's considered a frustration of the employment contract. And so what that means is if the government orders your business shut or aspects of your business shut, then it's not the employer's fault. So they don't have a choice, in which case they could legitimately lay you off and not have to pay you anything as a result. Right. So there is that nuance. So it'll depend on why it is that your employer has said you're now laid off or what they want to lay you off. So you have to look at that circumstance. Were they forced to stop operating? So maybe a different example of that could be, you know, massage clinics, right? And spas. They cannot offer their services in any way, shape, or form at this point. They're in-person services. So they're, you know, they would have had to have done a bunch of layoffs. And in that case, you know, their employees really can't recoup anything from the employer because they were forced to shut down. So that's different. There are other situations where an employer is saying, well, you know, we're losing a bit of business and we can't really reallocate our people. And so we're just going to like tell people, well, until things are better, you know, in the economy and our business, we won't call you back or we will never call you back or whatever. That's considered constructive dismissal. And in which case they still will owe you some compensation.
Okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but to get back to the question that you asked me originally, which is, you know, what if you're said, okay, well, now you have reduced hours, right? So let's say you worked 40 hours a week.
Sure.
Now they're saying, well, just come in for 20 hours. That too actually is considered a constructive dismissal because that reduction is so significant that it actually is like they're not respecting your normal contract, right? Now, having said all that, you know, this is sort of the theory around employment law and so on, and it will vary from province to province to some extent in terms of, you know, what the threshold, say, for reduction in your work hours is and so on. But in general, you know, if your employer has done this, you have to also look at, well, what kind of an employer do you have, right? Like, is this a big multinational company? Is this a bank or something with deep pockets and they're just like kind of taking advantage of the fact that, you know, there's this downturn and they're just like shedding workforce? In those cases, you may want to pursue something along the lines of, you know, seeking wrongful dismissal damages, which means like, you know, compensation for the fact that you were so-called laid off. But if you're working for a small business and they legitimately cannot pay.
That's a different situation.
That's a different scenario. And that has nothing to do with your legal rights, but it has to do with the reality of the situation. So people will have to judge on a case-by-case basis whether there's any merit in pursuing, you know, a wrongful dismissal case with their employer, again, depending on the circumstances.
No, I think the point to bear there is, I mean, I have several friends who work for small and medium-sized businesses, and they've all been told, we don't want to lay you off, but we can't afford to continuing as business as usual under these circumstances, right? So there's had to be
situation. Exactly. So the other situation is when you assess, you know, who is your employer, right? And whether they're being reasonable and like legitimately can't maintain their payroll, then if you agree to the layoff, so let's say they say to you, you know what, for now, let's just say we can't have you on board for the next 8 weeks,
right,
but as soon as, you know, things start to pick up, we'll bring you back. You can agree to that. And then that becomes a legitimate situation, right? And they can sometimes say to you, well, you know what, we'll still continue your benefits, but we just can't pay you right now, right? So those things are legitimate ways. So you can enter into an agreement with your employer to make it okay. But the thing is, again, you'll have to assess whether you want to do that, or if you think your employer is being unreasonable, that they actually have deep pockets, that they're just choosing to lay you off without compensating you, in which case you could potentially sue them for wrongful dismissal. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, I know that there's some people out there who are saying, oh, the courts are shut down, so your rights, you can't do anything about that. And that's not true. The courts are not actually like completely shut down. Like they're reduced operations right now. They're focusing on, you know, the urgent type cases and things that have to do with your freedom, you know, so criminal law, et cetera. But you're right, for something like wrongful dismissal, you actually have, usually it's like a 2-year limitation period. So you have a 2-year period to sue, right? So,
okay.
Don't be misinformed by people saying, oh, the courts are closed. No, like you still have legal rights and you still can pursue your claims if you have a case, right?
I think these are the basic points that get lost in all of the confusion, right? When people are going through this and mm-hmm. when you hear noise from multiple directions going on, you don't know what to believe. So people need a little bit of clarity to understand that, yeah, you do have a period of 2 years. You don't have to find legal representation the moment you are unfairly, in your opinion, laid off in that regard. You do have time. You can think through it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to make a rash decision.
That's true. You don't have to make a rash decision. But what I would recommend is, like, people do get the legal advice as soon as possible, because you can still get the advice. You can still talk to lawyers, even if the courts are not operating at full capacity right now. But the point is, the 2-year thing means, like, you don't have to actually launch your lawsuit till later, right? And one of the things that, you know, when I was a litigation lawyer in Toronto, one of the things that, you know, we would do is, you initiate a demand to the employer before you do the actual official thing in the court, right?
Okay.
When you start your lawsuit. So you do that in the hopes that the employer or whatever company you're suing is going to be willing to listen and actually negotiate a settlement ahead of time, so you can resolve this issue out of court. That's usually the best way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most cost effective, and it's better for both parties usually, right? So that's also something to think about. It doesn't mean you're going to be embroiled in, you know, a legal battle for years, but there are ways, and there's still merit in, if you think your situation warrants it, get some legal advice and see you know, what the options are in terms of when to do things and how to potentially resolve the situation that you're facing. So that kind of is the basics in terms of the legal situation. And just something else to think about, like, some people are still actually working, right? So for example, delivery companies, depending on what they're delivering, the kind of goods that they're delivering, they're still operating. And so, you know, it's important that the employer actually provides you a safe work space. So for example, you know, people who are working phone lines right now, if they have to work in a call center because it's specialized equipment or whatever, the employer has to provide their employee with a workplace that is safe. That is the case always. But under these circumstances, what being safe means can be different, right? So,
well, I have a question on that then,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for you. Okay, so once a week, I go out at the crack of dawn to the grocery store before the mass of people hit the stores. And employees that I see working at the various stores seem petrified, right? They're absolutely petrified because they're exposed to a wide range of people. You don't know who's sick. You don't know who you're interacting with. You can have all the personal protective equipment you want, but it's not a guarantee that you won't go home sick, but you need to work and you need to pay bills and everything that entails. So then my question is, what if an employee doesn't feel safe? What if you're working at a grocery store? And
you know,
this is a real thing, right? You're only going to be
The employer has to take, Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So the employer does have to take precautions. So, for example, in some grocery stores, they put up those plexiglass shields in front of the cashiers.
Sure.
I've seen some grocery store workers wearing masks. You know, that there are announcements being made in the grocery store saying, you know, for people to be at least 2 meters apart from each other. They've put lines on the floor to show where, you know, when you're lining up to pay, that you can only be this distance away from the cart in front of you, et cetera. So they're taking measures that, you know, are supposed to be to ensure the safety of their employees, and I guess in this case, the customers too. If you feel that your workplace is not safe, based on any amendments or none that the employer has made, you can actually ask for the Ministry of Labor, and it's going to depend on your province, but, you know, your Ministry of Labor, the occupational health and safety inspectors to come in and evaluate your workplace, and they will give an assessment of, you know, whether adequate measures have been taken.
Okay.
Until that assessment is made, you have the right to stay home. You know, you don't have to subject yourself to a working place that you think is unsafe.
Right.
Given these circumstances, I would hope most employers would understand employees who have a particular concern, especially, you know, like if they themselves are, you know, in an age group, for example, like people who are 70 years old and over, some people still work. And, you know, if for them, they feel it's unsafe for them to be at work, they should be able to negotiate something with their employer. If their work allows, like if the type of work they do is able to be done from home, the employer should accommodate that. And similarly, for people who have families, you know, one thing to remember that there's human rights legislation that says that you can't discriminate based on family status, right? So if people have children who are now not able to go to school because the schools are shut, that employee cannot come to work. The employer should allow them to stay home. Now, the employer obviously doesn't have to pay them if they're not going to be able to work from home. But the point is, you can't lose your job over, you know, your disability, your medical condition, or your children's, you know, the fact that your children are home and you have to take care of them, or if you have a sick person at home and you got to take care of that person, an elderly parent, et cetera, whatever. So I think this may be actually a good segue possibly to your side of things, where you're going to be talking about, well, if you are staying home and you're not able to get paid, whether because you've lost your job or because your employer's not paying you because you're not actually able to work from home, or you have to take care of a family member, et cetera. Like, the government has come up with a few things. Although, unless, I don't know, do you have any other questions that you want to...
I mean, that was the primary one. I mean, a couple of people have messaged me on Twitter and asked, you know, they're individuals who have underlying medical conditions, right? They're immunocompromised. They may be cancer survivors and there are various other medical situations. They're going, they haven't been given what we would call a reasonable accommodation in these circumstances because of the nature of their work. And they're going in not knowing whether or not they're walking out of work in the same shape that they walked in, right? And they realize they have to work. They're in a precarious situation. It's the prototypical example of somebody who is sick but working paycheck to paycheck to survive. And those are the people that are asking questions about, well, what about the funding that the government has pointed out? If I'm unable to work, yes, I understand we're getting $500 a week, but that's not going to cover my expenses. When you take into account my medical situation, disabilities, and every other pre-existing situation, that puts me in a high-risk category to be in public. So those are very real situations that these people face in a normal in normal circumstances. But now this is the new normal is taking it to a brand new level for all of these, for the entirety of society, right? And but we still have this vulnerable working group who are unsure of what they're going to be able to receive, what they'll be able to do, what protections they have, because it wasn't as if they were in a situation that was very secure to begin with and now put on a pandemic.
Right.
And everything has changed for them. And so
So I think that the bottom line is, you know, people will have to assess their particular circumstances based on the specifics of their situation. The thing is, employers cannot discriminate against you. Like, they can't say, you know what, we're just going to fire anybody who can't show up to work.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, we also have to think about, well, what is a reasonable alternative, right? Like, what can employers do to protect their employees. And so, as I mentioned, there are a couple of ways in which you can assess, have your workplace assessed for whether, you know, it is safe or not. You know, some employers have already taken the step of saying, you know what, like certain people, we don't want you coming in because of this or that or whatever. They should be able to make an arrangement with you, right? As to what happens. Now, if you're able to do the work from home, they should still pay you, obviously, for doing that work. If you cannot work because of the nature of your work and you're having to stay home and so on. I mean, I think this is, again, that's then the up to the government. I mean, there's, sure, you know, there are certain things that the government should be offering support for. And so why don't you go through some of that? Like, okay, what, who, sure, actually is the government helping to give, okay, some relief?
So here we have the, so we're talking about the Canada Emergency Response Benefit that was announced not that long ago, and it comes into effect on April 6, according to the government's website. So to access this, you don't need to have been laid off to get this help, a point that you made earlier, right? Where you can come to an agreement with your employer and you don't necessarily have to be laid off from your job. It's simply a case of you must be without employment income with it for at least 14 days during an initial 4-week period. So you can still technically be associated with your employer, but if you're not working, yeah, you can't access this funding. That's something that people need to be aware of. Also, a lot of questions, I just went through Twitter just to see what type of things were coming up in people's timelines with respect to this. A key thing was, well, how does this affect my EI? Ultimately, it does not affect your EI entitlement whatsoever if you go through the government's data that they present online. And I'll explain just how this works. So if you are on EI and say you're getting less than $500 a week, you're going to be automatically topped up to $500 a week, which is what the government is giving individuals in this circumstance. If your EI is above 500, you're going to come down to 500. And I'll explain why that's important from the government's perspective. Long term, though, once you come off this emergency response benefit program, your overall EI entitlement will not change. You will still get what you're entitled to. The reason why they're putting everybody to 500 is to get the money out fast. It's a delivery issue at this point. They want to get money into the hands of people. The government does understand that some people are going to lose a little bit, but that they're not going to lose it in their total entitlement. You still will get that. Your EI will not be impacted if you take advantage of this program. And I realize saying taking advantage is a horrible way of putting it, but if you need to use it. Some other things that we need to be aware of. You need to be residing in Canada, that goes without saying, at least 15 years of age. But one thing that the emergency response benefit lays out, which is proving to be a bit of an issue, and that's something I'll get to in a bit as well, is you need to have had an income of at least $5,000 in 2019. And many people will ask, well, who didn't have an income of $5,000 in 2019 to access this money? Well, seasonal workers, university students, students working during the summer months to make extra money, those are all individuals that in most cases make less than $5,000, and they are not eligible for this program because it doesn't work within the parameters of this program as a whole. So that's one group that has been, I wouldn't want to say excluded.
I think it's because right now what the program is for are for those who in March lost their income as a result of,
correct,
the COVID crisis.
Correct.
Right? That's not to say the government won't look at what else to do for other groups of people, but for now, the people who are covered under this, so that's the CERB, right? What does it stand for?
The Canada Emergency Response Benefit. It's to address those people, yeah, who are immediately, yeah, impacted. Now, as somebody, yeah, who teaches in post-secondary, I understand this very clearly. There's going to be students who are not going to be able to find work because of this. But as you pointed out, that's not to say the government is saying, oh, great, we can just get rid of these people and not worry about them. That's not the case, mm-hmm, whatsoever. This is, mm-hmm, this is the initial rollout of the legislation. You can't conceptualize what every eventuality will be, right? You have to be able to like augment and reiterate. You can't just have everything perfect.
And actually, just on the summer job thing, so people should be aware that if you've already landed a summer job, right, and you have a contract that's supposed to go between this date and that date, and you know how much you were going to get, you were going to get paid,
yes,
and so on. That contract is still valid, but if for whatever reason you're not able to actually have the job, or the employer says to you, you know what, we're canceling our summer jobs, et cetera, the only legitimate way they can do that without actually having to compensate you for that is if they're ordered shut. So for example, if you were going to be working in a summer camp, and let's say this summer the government says, you know what, we're not allowing any children's programs this summer, then that's that situation of frustration of the contract. So they can do that, obviously, because they're not allowed to operate. But if it's just that, again, employers are like, well, you know, we don't think there'll be a market for our product or our service this summer, we're just going to reduce the first workforce, et cetera. If you had a contract in place already, they still will have to compensate you to get you out of the contract. Mm-hmm. So that's just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, and that's something that's come up quite a bit. And I would just point out to everybody, just it is frustrating. It is a problem right now in terms of trying to figure out what your future will entail, especially for those in the post-secondary students or students going into university and whatnot, or people who have summer jobs. But it's an unprecedented situation. We can't get everything right on the first output of the policy, right? They have to evaluate it. They have to understand who they're helping and who needs
exactly
help.
And you know what, as somebody who's worked in government, I can tell you that putting together a new program from scratch at the speed that they've been doing it, it's almost like it's kind of unbelievable that they're able to do it. Like, it is completely unusual. Like, it usually takes, you know, more than a year or whatever to put a, you know, put something like this together. There are a lot of pieces that need to come together, a lot of coordination that needs to happen, and you know, for things to come out seamlessly. So the fact is, right now, they're really having to churn out these programs and make significant changes in a very short time frame. I think they're also doing the best they can under the circumstances. And we have to remember, like, the government, whether it's civil servants or the politicians or whatever, they're dealing with the same things we're dealing with, right?
Sure,
like,
they're
also having to work remotely for the most part. They're dealing with the anxiety and the stresses. They have their kids at home too, you know, like they're dealing with the same things we are. So we also have to kind of be mindful of that as they're rolling out, you know, they're obviously doing their jobs, but it just to be a bit understanding of why some of the confusion is out there, because they're working at lightning speed under very difficult circumstances.
I mean, and that's something that we oftentimes forget, right? When there's a crisis at hand here, they're human beings too. They experience the same issues that we're experiencing.
Yeah.
And I'm not to say that you ought to give them slack if there's bad policy, but we need to understand that there will be more iterations of this and they will be augmenting it. It's not a set in stone that this is how the policy will be working, because they can't cover everything in the first sweep, as you pointed out, right? It just cannot be done in that sense. So go ahead, you were saying.
So given that, you know, everyone's kind of going through this really difficult period right now, we did think that we would do political and media wins instead of fails for the week.
Uplifting.
We'll try. So the political win that I'm going to talk about is basically the federal, provincial, and territorial coordination and collaboration that's going on right now in a general sense. I mean, obviously, you know, when it comes to something health related, that's both there's like a federal responsibility and provincial ones. Of course, there's also municipalities involved, and there's just had to be a lot of coordination and collaboration between these different orders of government in terms of delivery of service, in terms of communicating information, just so many things, like even procuring some of the medical equipment and the protective equipment, et cetera. Like, it just, there's a lot of collaboration going on across our country.
Yeah.
And I think that's a political win for those in the various orders of government, because it is not to be taken for granted. We only need to look south of the border to see what a disaster, you know, it could be, right? And it isn't for us. So that, I think, we have to you know, give credit to the different orders of government.
And just to build on that just for a quick moment. I've done, as somebody who's done quite a bit of research on looking at the whole of government response to the outbreak of SARS in the early 2000s, I can assure you from what I've seen, what the government, the various levels of government are doing today is a direct reflection of the lessons that they learned in their response to SARS. SARS by no means was as devastating as this, but nonetheless, they learned some real lessons in terms of coordination and delegation and trust in government and with frontline workers, especially with frontline workers, whether they're the people who service our food or whether it's the ambulatory or the police or whomever, but they have certainly learned those lessons. And we're seeing many of them in play today in the government's response.
And
think about
it. And actually the Public Health Agency of Canada, didn't exist back then. Like the Public Health Agency of Canada was set up as a result of the lessons learned from the SARS experience.
Absolutely.
And I suspect there will be lessons learned from this experience too down the road. But okay, what is your media win of the week?
Typically, it was hard for me to find one specific example of a media win. And then I stood back and I thought about it a little bit more. And the media win for me is how the various networks have drawn attention to what the public needs to do in terms of social distancing and protocol and whatnot. And when we, in a couple of minutes, I'll get into deeper detail on why it's important. So, the media has played a good role, a really good role, I think, in not just naming and shaming violators of public protocol, but showing us what not to do, right? Like what the key issues are. They've brought a huge range of infectious disease experts who are speaking Canadians in normal terminology, right? So if I watch Global or CTV or CBC, and I'll see a whole representation of different backgrounds within their guests who are talking about what we need to do, and the advice that they are giving you is pragmatic and very straightforward and easily understandable. And that's a testament to what these media organizations are doing and the people that they are bringing on to communicate this message. Now, ultimately, the effectiveness of this message will be, does the public do what they're being told is necessary to do, right? I mean, it's an individual decision. But the way they're presenting these medical experts, the way they're presenting these people and explaining what we need to do is being a huge media win. I've never seen anything as efficiently done as this. Tip of the hat to the various media organizations who have engaged our medical community to tell us what the points are that we need to bear in mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. And I think actually before we close up this episode, I think it might be helpful just to kind of share a couple of things that are helping us cope through this experience. And I think in part, you know, from my perspective, I was somebody who had to isolate myself from people for a long time. It ended up being a few years post-concussion because I had extreme symptoms. I couldn't be around people. So in order for me to recover, I needed to basically be happy to be on my own a lot. And so the way I managed through that time is just to kind of take it a day at a time, not pay attention to the time that's passing or the time that's ahead, because I didn't know, just like now we don't know how long this is going to go on for. And instead, I just sort of focused on the present and tried to remind myself of the things that I could do, the things that I couldn't control. I just was like, okay, well, I have to accept that. And I just like, don't focus on it. But the things that I did control, the things that I, you know, was still able to do, I really took pleasure in the smaller things. You know, I learned, I actually gained a better appreciation for nature at the time.
Right.
You know, I got into audiobooks because at the time I couldn't read, I couldn't even see at a certain point. Like I was in bad shape, but you know, I learned to cope by finding things that, you know, made me happy or that gave me something to do. And over time, you know, things got better, and we have to remind ourselves, this is temporary. This is not going to be forever. It's going to be a hard road. And trust me, this is hard even for me, who has a lot of experience with isolation, right? Like it is hard, but we have to remember this is not going to be forever. And that we're, you know, we're in a position in Canada where, you know, we're relatively safe. in terms of, you know, we don't have bombs dropping on us. Like, we have a
sure.
government that's functional and many orders of government that are really working hard to try to make this crisis go smoothly as it possibly can. So I think just kind of reminding ourselves of those things and just finding things that give you joy. Like, I have actually just downloaded a whole bunch of historical fiction audiobooks because, like, that's my escape, because I don't
sure.
want to just think about COVID all the time.
No, you
so I don't know. What do you have any parting thoughts on that?
Personally, yes. I mean, for many people, it's a very scary and dark time, mainly because of the uncertainty, right? You don't know how long this is going to last. You don't know how you'll be feeling tomorrow. Will you get sick? Won't you get sick? From a personal point of view, the measures that we're being asked to implement in our lives today are something that myself and my family have been used to for several years right now. Some of you know I have a medically fragile daughter who before the age of one was diagnosed with a medical situation, and they gave her very little time. And one of the things that was very important for us at that time was infection control. And it changed our entire life in how we viewed things and how we viewed what is important, what is not. And one of the things that came out of the experience that we've had over the last 4 years or so, and it echoes much of what you said, is you have to be able to appreciate what you can control. Most things you cannot control one bit, but there's some things you can control, and you have to take hope in that, you know, and you have to try
and keep hope.
The positive.
That's faith. Like,
you have
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I often say, I said to my students, who I taught for years, when the announcement of, you know, COVID and the pandemic and the measures came into play, it didn't faze me to the extent that many others did, because I know what we need to do. And the first thing is, you don't give up hope. Don't lose hope. And the second thing you have to do, listen to the goddamn experts who are telling you what you need to do to stay safe. Right.
Yeah.
Those like, don't give up hope and listen and be sensible. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't
agree. But just on the experts, if you hear conflicting things,
right.
just use your judgment then, you know,
yes.
like, because there is a bit of that. Like, some people are like, don't do this, don't do that, whatever. But just like, I would like, I'm very like, let's assess the risk of things. And like,
sure.
right now, just do the most that we can to minimize the risk to ourselves, to our families, to other people, you know, like that, I think, can be our guiding principle.
Just to limit risk, I'll just leave it with this. My daughter's grandparents live very close to us. We haven't seen them in 3 weeks. They used to see each other multiple times a week. That's called social distancing, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you have to take it very seriously, and you have to think of it.
Are you guys doing like video chats with
every
them
day,
or something at
every
least?
Every day.
Excellent.
Multiple times a day.
So you
got to
find alternate ways.
Yep.
Exactly.
We just stream it to the TV, and there they are on a big screen TV.
Oh, nice.
Right?
That's fancy. A fancy setup. Okay.
Well, no, I just stream my phone. It's nothing fancy. It's an old TV, but it works, right? Make use of whatever you have, whatever technology you have, whatever things you have, just make use of them.
Even the telephone. Yeah.
Even the landline.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Use of the landline.
Yeah. Some of us still have one, but anyways. I think that's a, you know, we wanted to end things on a positive note. We're going to come to you on Twitter to ask what you might want us to talk about next time, because I think some of the other topics we were thinking of talking about, you know, before the crisis hit, maybe is not appropriate right now, but we want to get some guidance from you as to like, well, what would be a good thing for us to talk about? We hope that this was helpful. We hope you all stay safe. We'll be back in short order. Take care.
This is Fun, the FU Network.